Welcome to Research Bites, the podcast about research students and their journey in academia. My name is Lachlan Gray. I'm joined by Imtiaz Desai, and we have a very special guest, Therese Johansson, who is a very close to finishing PhD student from the Uppsala University in Stockholm, Sweden. Therese is a population geneticist and an epidemiologist, and we're really excited to hear about her work today. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So we'll start off as we usually do about how you got into your PhD. Now you're in Sydney now, not in Sweden. So you've had a slightly longer journey here than many others may. So tell us a story. How did you get into it?
Okay, long story short, sort of.
No, long version.
This
is a 2-hour podcast.
Okay, minimum, you know. Wow. Okay, so I started studying medicine with sort of a major in biomedicine at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. And I really got interested into research, and I thought it was so interesting to see what is going on back office, sort of, and not what's going on in the clinic. Like, how do we treat diseases? How do we investigate why diseases even occur, and how can we prevent them even happening? So during my master's, I contacted a research group in epidemiology. More specifically, they are doing research in eating disorders and the genetic contribution to eating disorders, which I thought was like, wow, this is so cool. And it's called the Anorexia Nervosa Genetics Initiative. So it's global, and they're collecting data on like this big, big cohort where they are sequencing the whole genome of 16,000 people with anorexia nervosa, like they have had it in their lifetime. So I contacted this PI, and I was like, this sounds so cool. Is it a possibility for me to do like my master thesis? And that's sort of how I came into genetic epidemiology. And I got access to this really amazing data set, created polygenic risk scores. And I was like, if I can do this and get paid, that is amazing. So that's sort of how I decided to continue with a PhD.
Follow the money, yeah.
And they
say PhDs are very well paid as well. So it's a really good way to make coin. Yeah, it's a good investment strategy.
I was very smart. I was like, okay, here's the money. Yeah, definitely. No, not really. But, you know, I was a student back then. And that's also off topic. It's a bit different, I've understood, being a PhD here in Australia compared to Sweden. So in Sweden, you have a salary. So you're not considered a student in the same way. You're employed and you have a salary and you have your retirement savings and you have all these social securities that you get as an employee by the government. So it's a slightly different. I mean, it's not amazing salary, but it is salary. And then I got contacted by this professor at Uppsala University, where I'm now. And she met me during a course, during my bachelor's thesis, or during my bachelor in medical genetics. And I thought she was super cool. And apparently she liked me as well. So she emailed and said like, hi, I got some funding. If you're interested in doing a PhD after you finish your master's, which is like half, I had my thesis left. So I had half a year left. I will be happy if you can come and start your PhD. I didn't think that long about it. I was like, yeah, of course. I knew what they were doing, and it was pretty much the same, but instead of eating disorders, they look at complex diseases, cardiovascular disease, cancer, obesity. So that's how I got into my PhD. So I finished my master's. I got admitted like the week after, pursued my PhD. And then halfway through my PhD, I was pretty tired. I was like, I need a change. So in Sweden, we have something called half time, which is when you've done half your PhD studies, you have a mini dissertation. You write a half time thesis report and you present it and you have an examining committee and just to like see how it's going, if you are ready in 2 years to actually have your like big dissertation. And I think like the areas got out of me after that. I was like, oh, okay, now that's done. Am I just going to continue doing sort of being in the same environment for 2 additional years? I want to see another group like working. I talked with my supervisors about this and they were like, go to Australia. It's great. And 2 weeks later, I had contacted this professor at Garvan and I arranged a visa and I booked the flights. And I think 1.5 months after the initial thought, I was here in Sydney.
Wow, that's a fast move.
Yeah, it was a fast move. I think some people were like, oh, you're in Sydney now. I was like, oh yeah, I forgot to tell you. But yeah, I left. And as many people who come to Australia or Sydney from Sweden, we fall in love because of the weather as a big part, of course. But also I thought it was so interesting to see. It's always interesting to see how other people work, how research is going on in another country, completely like on the other side of the world. And I came in a really good group, like clinical epidemiology. They were doing not exactly what I was doing, but they had, which I also think is good because you get an exchange that is so valuable.
And who was this with? Which professor?
This was with Professor Jacqueline Center.
Okay.
So they're doing mostly bone research. I don't do bone research, but I look at hormones. And hormones is actually a prevention of bone loss. So they knew about it, but more specifically, they know a lot about the epidemiology methods that we are working with. So they could help me or support me with that. But so that's how I ended up here. And then I thought I want to pursue with a postdoc in Sydney. So this is something that in Sweden, at least, you should move country after a PhD.
Do you mean it's encouraged?
It's very encouraged.
Oh.
Staying in the same group is big no-no. After a PhD, going abroad, great. It shows that you can move, you're flexible. It's also very encouraged by like Sweden to go to another country, get like new knowledge from another country, another group, come back and establish your group after.
So it's not just a thing in academia. It's part of the Swedish culture.
I think it's, yeah. I know Sweden, so I can't speak for every other country, but in Sweden, it's very much like this.
Cool. And there's another quite significant difference between the Australian system and the Swedish system is that you're basically, to get your thesis, you have to publish every single chapter, right?
Yeah. You have to, if I remember it correctly, but yeah, you have to have 4 papers published. And 2 of them should be first author, but 2 of them can be manuscripts. They don't have to be published yet, but they are in the shape of being submitted, but they don't have to have been accepted, because publishing 4 papers in 4 years, that's quite a lot.
Yeah, especially when journal reviewers take their time to get back to you.
Especially reviewer 2.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I got a revision back. It was 9 reviewers.
Ooh.
With like 8-10 comments each.
Ooh. Sounds like a nightmare.
It is. I'm so angry. Now
it's like
I'm
a thesis
like
of reviewer comments.
Yeah. I was like, when I got the email, I was just scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. And I was like, does it stop? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then is it also true because, so you're saying that, you know, once you finish your PhD in Sweden, it's very encouraged to move overseas. Is that kind of because if you go to a lab in Sweden, go check out all these papers I've published, they'd be like, yeah, you had to, like, so did everyone else. You know what I mean? Is that like part of it? Is that why moving overseas? Of course, there's that exchange of ideas, but it's kind of like the standard is already quite high?
Yeah, it could be. That's a good question. Just like, could be like that, of course, but it's not only about the publication. I mean, it's still a competition because it's like, where did you publish? What journal did you publish in? So even though everyone finished their doctoral degree with publications, it's also a matter of like, where did you actually publish your papers or your projects? So that is also, but I do, it is a bit sad in one way that I feel like the culture, maybe it's more at universities than like institutes, that is such a like publish or perish system.
Oh, that's the whole world. It's not just...
Yeah.
Where you are, yeah.
He's not only there, yeah. No.
Yeah. Well, should we get stuck into, I guess, the science of your work?
Yeah.
Do you want to start at sort of like maybe a high level? So I feel like, you know, people listening to this, they'll probably have an understanding of that. We have DNA in our cells, this sort of genetic blueprint. But what is understood now about our genetics and disease? Is it as simple as, you know, one gene, one disease, or is it like more complicated than that?
Yeah. So, yeah, it is way more complicated than that. So we have something I worked with something called polygenic risk scores,
mm-hmm.
or polygenic scores. It doesn't always need
to be. I'm sorry, in the accent, that's polygenic.
Yeah, polygenic. Polygenic. Basically what we know today so far about complex diseases is that there is so many genetic variants that contribute with a small, tiny effect to your risk of developing a complex disease or disorder. And so what polygenic risk scores does is that it basically creates this individualized score, which sets your risk of getting a disease based on your whole DNA. So we kind of just see how these genetic variants collectively contributes to the risk for a disease. So that is something that we are working with in the group to just sort of identify high-risk individuals. And one of my projects was for eating disorders, where I looked at individuals that have had a long-term eating disorder. So this was sort of a proof of concept study. So we wanted to see if people that have a really hard time getting like remission from their eating disorder have a higher genetic contribution to their disorder rather than environmental. What you do is a genome-wide association study where you basically collect a bunch of people with the disease you wanted to...
It's more than a bunch. It's usually like thousands, if not like millions of individuals, yeah. Right?
I mean, the more the better.
Mm.
For a disease like anorexia, it's hard to collect that money. There is a genetic initiative called Anorexia Nervosa Genetics Initiative, which is a global sort of effort to sequence people. I mean, they also here from Australia, from Sweden, from US. I can't remember all the countries where they took blood samples and looked at their DNA in sort of trying to unravel the genetic underpinnings of eating disorders, not only anorexia nervosa, but also other eating disorders. So with this data set, I could calculate these polygenic risk scores and then apply them on a Swedish sample of patients that had long-term anorexia to calculate their individual risk. And what we could see, what we thought as well, is that the higher genetic risk you have, the higher risk you have of developing a long-term eating disorder. Mm. So you have a hard time actually recover. So if you could take a blood test when people come into the clinic the first time when they seek treatment, and you can see, okay, this person has a high genetic risk, which means like maybe this person needs another type of treatment or a longer treatment, because this is an individual that is more difficult to actually get healthy or go into remission. Yeah.
And is that happening at the clinic level now?
No, it's not. I think that's the downside of getting this into the clinic is really, really difficult. And of course, there is more studies that needs to be done.
Yeah.
But with the like low price of especially like whole gene or genotyping.
Yeah.
I don't think we're that far away to actually use it in the clinic.
Yeah, but there's like a few examples, at least in Australia, where they're using, you know, probably like panels of genetic variants or possibly even whole genome sequencing to prescribe medications. There's like the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, whatever. They've now made prenatal testing of different genetic diseases like available. So slowly and surely, the influence of like genomics into clinical practice is getting there. But where do you see, like, it's interesting, you know, using these polygenic risk scores in like a totally different cohort, and then looking at your Swedish cohort and seeing if there's like an overlap or you can make predictions based on that information. Is that how you see polygenic risk scores being used into the future? Like, are there other applications that you could see?
Oh, that is a good question. Yeah. I think there is like a lot of both like dangerous applications it can be used. Mm. I don't know if you heard about like embryonic screening, like using polygenic risk scores on embryos.
No, I haven't.
So basically, because we know that we are in the beginning of actually identifying the effect of these genetic variants. So far, we have like too few people. I think there is a missing heritability, right? We can't identify everything in these genome-wide association studies that we use for polygenic risk scores. The heritability is so small. It explains so little of the heritability. So we're missing something. And then we use polygenic risk scores to basically select an embryo that is like the fittest based on a different criteria, maybe cardiovascular disease, cancer risk.
But and then intelligence, maybe.
Yeah, maybe intelligence, like even, yeah.
Athletic performance.
Oh God. So. I reckon that person would be a real bastard, like really good at sports, really smart, you know.
Yeah. So that's one like dangerous, really dangerous, do you call it slippery slope?
Yeah.
Another application, except using like prediction, but that is sort of what I touched upon, is to identify high risk individuals and maybe have it like in the, like in Sweden, when people are born, we take the blood. And this is also a bit scary, but to look at like the risk for people developing certain disorders that can be modifiable by like change in lifestyle.
Yeah.
Or by certain drugs like statins, for example, we use cardiovascular disease. But then there are certain diseases that you actually can't do much about. And that's also, yeah. There is a lot of ethical consideration.
That's definitely true. Like, you know, people getting those like ancestry tests, like 23andMe and that sort of stuff, and then finding out they have like Huntington's or whatever. It's like, what do you do with that information? Mm. You know?
So, yeah. So from your perspective, now that you've got, you know, you've worked globally, where do you see that sort of testing going? How do we do it ethically while avoiding... Look, there's always going to be Sorry, that was the cleaners popping in there.
Should we get them on the podcast? I think. Yeah. Someone have a take.
I mean, there's always going to be people who take it where it shouldn't go.
Mm.
It's, I guess you could say it's human nature, right?
Mm.
How do you see it being managed well?
That's a big question.
Yeah, it's a big question, right?
And I don't know if I have the answer. I think it's with everything that's new. The legalization, do you say that?
Yeah.
Is always behind. And I think this will be, it's already taken advantage of.
Yeah.
For example, 23andMe or other genetic testing companies that basically claims all this stuff based on your polygenic risk, we're so in the beginning of it. We can't really say that much. But one field that, if we take breast cancer, for example, so in Sweden, probably here in Australia, we have genetics, or we have screening, not genetic screening. Yeah, we have for certain genetic variants. But that's the problem. We have certain genetic variants. We don't look at the whole genome, or we don't do genotyping of 800,000 SNPs. Like, so we cover the whole genome. Usually you look at like 10. And then you miss a lot of individuals that also have a high genetic risk.
Mm.
Because you're only looking at certain variants that we know about, but there is so much more. So I think that is a really good application, like using, instead of looking for 10 genetic variants, use genotyping, look at the whole genome, so we can capture more. Same with pharmacogenomics. We look at specific genetic variants, but I think polygenic risk scores could capture even more people that could benefit from a tailored treatment or
and I guess like a big so I know that you work with the UK Biobank, which is where one of the largest sort of databases of genetic information with like all these different traits, but of course that's in a Caucasian population, right? And so a lot of these genetic variants are associated with certain diseases, and you have like a panel of them, and you go, okay, if you've got 8 out of 10 of these variants or whatever, then you probably have this disease. What populations were those genetic variants like found in? So I think that's a big thing that we have to consider. But I guess sort of like moving slightly away from the ethical side of things, because we can talk about all the limitations and all the real like murky, troubling things that are probably coming our way into the future. But I think some of your other research looking at the contraceptive pill or like exogenous like hormones, that is like a really interesting application looking at something that I don't think people have really appreciated as much, right? So yeah, could you discuss a bit more about that project?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that's like one of my definitely major projects, contraceptives and the side effects of contraceptives. So just to give you a backstory, they were approved 1957, but not for contraceptive purposes or birth control purposes. But around 60s, women could use them that were not married. And already back then, during the 60s, the side effects of blood clots or thrombosis came up, like I think 61, like 1 year after it was widely available. And then of course they lowered the dosages of estrogen because they see, okay, it's because of the estrogen doses. So they lowered that and they changed some of the progestin, which is the second hormone in combined contraceptive pills. But there is so many other side effects that we don't really talk about contraceptives, that like possible side effects, both good and bad, doesn't necessarily need to be negative side effects. But now it's like since the 1960s, so how many years have passed? 60 years. So now we can actually start to look at long-term effects. So people have used the pills for a long time, what happened like later, and even interesting what happens maybe in the offsprings of people taking contraceptives. So I started one of the projects looking into cancers using the UK Biobank, which is a great resource if you want to look at long-term effects, because this is a cohort of relatively old people. So they have used contraceptives during the 60s to 80s. And I have follow-up data up until 2000. At least I had 2018, I think.
Wow, that long.
Yeah, so it's a really long time follow-up. There is limitations with the data, of course, with every data set. But we could see what is interesting. We could see a decrease. So we looked at endometrial cancer, ovarian cancer, and breast cancer. And we could see a decreased risk of both ovarian and endometrial cancer, even like 35 years after they stopped taking the pill, which is quite interesting. And it was a 50% reduction compared to people who have never used contraceptive pills. Breast cancer, we couldn't see any clear
effects. Wait, just repeat that. So having taken the contraceptive reduce your likelihood of reproductive cancers, essentially. Is that what you're saying?
Endometrial and, yeah, ovarian cancer. Wow. Yes. Mm.
Interesting. Do we know why that is?
Not really. Not 100%. Like, there is theories, a hypothesis about why that is. Because it's sort of past the ovulation, like you have less cell divisions in your ovaries. But that doesn't really, because you don't save your eggs when you're on contraceptive pills, which is a common thought that people have. So it's not really clear why you actually have a decreased risk of ovarian cancer.
Is there a correlation with the number of like pregnancies you've had and your amount of, because I guess during pregnancy you're not like ovulating, so you're having like less of that cell division and growth. Is there an association there as well?
I think there is an association between pregnancy and lower risk of ovarian cancer, but I'm not sure. I can't really tell. But in our analysis, we adjusted for pregnancies. So it should not influence our estimates. And if it does influence our estimates, it should be the opposite effect. So the people who did not take contraceptive pills had more birth. So they then should be more protected. So it would dilute our estimate.
I see.
Yeah.
So if we just take a little, not so much a step back, but more looking at how you do this research, right? The benefit of having these biobanks is so much data retrospectively. In drugs, for example, what is commonly used would be the randomized control trials. So you've got those control subjects, which is really important, right? What are some of the technique you use when looking at that retrospective data to give you some of the same rigidity of a randomized control trial?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And that's like where we all strive as epidemiologists working with observational data to do everything we can to come as close to a randomized clinical trial. So in UK Biobank, we definitely have an issue with recall bias as well. Because they self-reported the information about the contraceptive pills. Something that is commonly done and that I have worked with to adjust for or to replicate the randomization process is something called inverse probability weighting. So you basically balance the groups. So say that the groups not taking contraceptives, for example, they have more pregnancies, and people taking the opposite. People who don't take contraceptives, they have had more pregnancies. And people who have taken contraceptives, they have less pregnancies. So that's a confounder that can confound our estimates. Then you can do a calculation that where you basically make them the same And that's inverse probability weighting. I am not a statistician, even though I apply a lot of statistics. So I can't explain like the theory behind everything of that. Another common approach is adjustment, where you include it as a covariate in your model. But that also requires you have to have all the known confounders, and they need to be measured. And that's not always the case in these data sets. And then we have confounders that we don't know actually affect this association. So then I have also, so I worked with UK Biobank, which is a great resource, but then we have something that is even better, which is like a gold mine in Sweden. And that's the Swedish Nationwide Registers. Here we don't have any recall bias because every citizen in Sweden, they are tracked. So we get a personal identification number when we are born. And every time we go to a hospital, this is in a register. So, and it's not for research purposes. It's for administrating the population. And every time we go to a pharmacy and take out a new prescription or redeem a new prescription, that's also tracked, the specific date when that happened. If we get cancer, if we die, why we died, if we get pregnant, so what education we have, where we live.
Wow, that's a lot of data just floating around. Okay.
I know a lot of people probably is like, oh, wow, that's scary that you were so tracked. I think that's another topic.
About we'll get into that later. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is an amazing resource to conduct the same type of studies looking at contraceptives. But the drawback in UK Biobank, I don't have the specific type of contraceptive. So maybe you know that contraceptives can come in different shapes and forms. It can be as a pill, it can be as an injection, it can be an intrauterine system, it can be an implant, and it can be different hormones, different combination of hormones. And it's not a lot of research on that because we don't have the data sets that are so fine grade that you can actually look at specific types. And you also need huge amount of people to look at like 10 different types. So then I applied to use the Swedish Nationwide Registers, and I used a new type of study design that is called emulated target trial.
Oh, yes, you brought it up. That's what I was digging at earlier, yeah. But it came up.
Is this something you heard about before?
No.
So I have, yes, fortunately, but Felix is keen to know. Felix, this one's for you. And Lachlan hasn't heard either. I think it's a great topic for us to dig into a little bit. Yeah, explain it, please.
Yes. So, should I say this? It is a bit of a buzzword, maybe.
Yeah, it is. Okay, yeah. It's okay to say that.
It's a bit like a low-hanging fruit, a bit like Mendelian randomization have been for some time. Oh my God, I'm saying all this. Yeah. But anyway, so I think it kind of exploded in Sweden because Miguel Hanan, which is the sort of the father of emulated target trials, he's in Stockholm, so he's affiliated to Karolinska Institute. And I went to a course that he was given about emulated target trials my first year doing my PhD, and I was like, oh, this is cool, like this is a new thing. I had worked a lot with survival analysis with UK Biobank. I was going to work with the Swedish Nationwide Registers, and I thought, I want to try a new method, so why not just see if this gives me something different? So basically what it is it's quite simple and straightforward. So I had worked in clinical trials during my master's as a company called IQVIA, where it's a contract research organization where pharmaceutical companies outsource their clinical trials to. And I had worked in that field, so we'd randomize clinical trials. So I had that knowledge about like writing a study protocol, the randomization project process, and what type of statistical analysis you do. So for me, it was quite a nice bridge using observational data, applying my knowledge of clinical trials on that data set. But so first of all, you write a study protocol that is emulating the trial. You pretend that you were doing a randomized clinical trial. How would that look like? Like the perfect trial. And then you look at your data set and you're like, okay, can I do exactly like that? And I think first what you do, you identify all the biases you have, which is such an important thing in observational studies. You identify and see like, oh, I can't actually do that. What does that mean on my estimates? How does that affect my results? If I can't, well, first of all, randomize. You can't do that, or I don't have this confounder that might skew these results, or I can't follow them up at the same time point. How does that affect my estimates? So that's the first step. And then I think something that is called immortal time bias, which is very common in observational studies. I don't know if you heard about it. It's basically when you start following people, say at time zero, and then people can start the drug after that time point. That time is immortal. People can't die. For the only people who actually started treatment after that time point, they survived. And there we have the big, big bias. But with emulated target trials, you avoid that because you put a time zero. This is where I will have my eligibility criteria. This is the people I gonna let be in my trial, hypothetical trial. And they're gonna start treatment this day or not start treatment this day. And then I'm gonna follow them for 2 years. And then I'm gonna look at the difference in incidence rate between treated and non-treated, without considering whether they stopped, which can also be a bias, like that you stop following people when they start the assigned treatment. So I don't know if that gave you, but to sum up, it's just a way for you to avoid common pitfalls in observational studies.
Mm. And so in this study on contraceptives, you're looking at the effect of depression, I guess. Like, I was gonna say mental health, but it was like specifically depression. So you're looking at, okay, people taking this drug, yes or no, and then how long until they were diagnosed with depression. Does that feed into this?
In the hormonal contraception and depression paper, I did an emulated target trial where I did like a sequence of trials to increase my power. But what I did is I basically, as you would do a trial, I recruited people that is 14 to 34 years of age. They are reproductive. They have not used contraceptives before, so they are new users. And I'm going to start follow them month in July 2007. And then I follow them as if it would be a clinical trial for 2 years. And then I look, after 2 years, I see, okay, how does the incidence rate between people who use and people who don't use look like? So that's pretty much. But then, of course, there is, you have to consider confounding because I don't have the randomization part. Mm. And that's where I use inverse probability weighting. Mm.
Mm. Yeah. And then what did you find?
So this is a sort of a controversial topic. I'm not against contraceptives. I think it's great because women can plan their careers and their lives. But I think it's very important that we know about all the side effects. Women should know what they are taking. And so what we saw was that we looked at, I can't remember how many, but maybe 10, 15 different types of contraceptives based on the hormonal contact, but also the route of administration. So we can see that there is an increased risk of depression. It's not major, But there is an increased risk, and it seems to be the progestin that is responsible for this increased risk. If you especially look at the intrauterine systems, which is like the hormone spiral, they come in three different dosages, 13, 19, and 52 milligrams of progestin. And there we can see almost like a dose response relationship, that the higher dose, the higher risk of depression. But then for some of the combined contraceptives, we saw just a slightly increased risk. But I think an important message, we looked for 2 years. So that's a short-term effect. That is like when you start using them. Have you used contraceptives for 5 years and you feel great on them? Don't stop taking them. That's absolutely not. But if you started taking contraceptives and you feel like, I feel off, I don't feel like I used to, talk to your like GP, talk to your like healthcare professionals and discuss this. Because I think what is missed is you go to a psychiatrist when you feel really low. The psychiatrist never asks you, or a psychologist, did you start taking any contraception the last few months? No, they don't. So I think if it's known, I think we could capture way more women that actually got depressed by starting a contraception. But I think it's a subset of women, not all women. It's a small subset.
And it could be as simple as just changing whatever you take, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Changing whatever you take.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that there's this knowledge out here, because, you know, when the contraceptive is inevitably developed for men, it'd be nice that all this work's been done so we don't have to deal with with any of that. Because, you know, I don't want to be sad and bloaty, you know. I want to have one that works, you know.
Yeah. I think it would probably work very differently for men.
Classic. Yeah. So there's a breadth of work you've touched on just in our chat, right? There's anorexia, there's depression, and it's linked with contraceptive pills. We touched on a little bit of thrombosis there too. Are there any particular areas of interest that really hook you, that you'd like to keep working on? Or are you more interested in the methods behind it? For example, fine-tuning the emulated target trials, or trial design, methodologies, populations?
I think that's a really good question. And when you say, like, I thought I always had hated like method development, but I realized I think it's so fun. And like causal inference, which is like emulated target trials under that sort of umbrella, is something that I think is super interesting. But I would like to apply causal inference in other areas, like genomics as well. Yeah. So combining them.
Yeah. So, did you have something you want to say, MTS?
Well, I was going to ask what's left on the PhD and what are post-PhD plans?
So what's left? Writing up the thesis. And then I also have two papers in like revision state. So it's a lot going on. And that's on contraception and repression, and on menopausal hormone therapy and cardiovascular disease, which is another drug that I looked at. And then planning for the dissertation party, which is a big thing in Sweden. It's sort of a wedding.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I have booked a venue. I have set the menu. I write invitation like letters, and it's been so much work with that.
Oh, wow. I'm not sure if we need to adopt that culture here.
I think you should. I mean, it's fun. It
sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah.
I've been so like, should I just like not have it? And then like, I will regret if I don't have the...
Of course, yeah, you got to do it.
Can you do joint ones? So for example, we might be finishing at the same time. Could we do a joint dissertation party?
In Sweden, no.
Oh.
You can't have a dissertation the same day as someone else.
Oh.
So you're very special that day.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, I like that.
Yeah, you're very special. But that's the plan ahead. And then, so I'm going back to Sweden to do that in May. And after that, I will hopefully start my postdoc here.
In Sydney?
In Sydney.
At the Garvan?
At the Garvan in genomics. Yeah. And hopefully a bit of causal inference. Mm. Mm.
So that's the future. What about the past? So where you'd like to ask this question, if you were to go back in time to maybe the start of your PhD or even start of your master's or anything, have there been any like lessons that you've learned, like, you know, personal lessons or professional lessons or whatever that you could sort of wish you could go back in time and tell yourself before you started?
Don't take everything too seriously, I think, definitely. And have fun. And don't, because of this publish and perish, it's been such a huge pressure for that. I think so, yeah. Probably have a bit more fun. Don't take it way too seriously, even if it's research. I mean, you should have fun too.
Yeah, nice. That's good advice. All right, well, yeah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate this chat. Like, I've learned a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All of the best with the end of the PhD, and we look forward to seeing you back at the Garvan in Sydney soon.
Yeah, so do I. Thank you so much for having me. It was really nice.
Cool. All right. Bye.
Bye.